The Book Nook on WYSO was presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Philip Isle. His book, Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer, just came out in a paperback. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Vic.
Are you in Providence, Rhode Island by any chance?
I am indeed, calling you from my hometown.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you coming back on the show. We had you on for the hardcover, and this is just such an amazing story. And the Ohio connection is also very strong. So I really wanted to have you back on to talk about it some more, because I'm sure there's some things that we didn't cover the first time around. Plus, it's been out for a while, and I want to know what kind of response you've been getting. But first of all, tell us how your dad was involved in you discovering this story.
So Prescription for Pain tells the story of a man named Paul Volkman, who is currently serving 4 consecutive life terms in federal prison for prescription drug dealing for crimes that took place from 2003 to 2006, mainly in Scioto County in Portsmouth in southern Ohio, but the last couple months there were in Chillicothe. And I had never met Paul Volkman growing up. I hadn't ever really even heard his name. But I would later learn that he went to college at the University of Rochester and also medical school, an MD-PhD program at the University of Chicago, with my dad, Dr. Charles Isle. Now, my dad is a kind of nerdy, soft-spoken, law-abiding guy who doesn't drink, doesn't do drugs, doesn't gamble. He's a really mild-mannered guy. And when I learned that this former long-lost classmate of my dad was facing this, at that time, when I first learned about it in 2009, Volkman had been indicted. He hadn't gone on trial yet. But when I learned that this old classmate of my dad was facing these astonishing federal charges of a massive prescription drug dealing scheme involving cash-only clinics, clinics with armed guards, enormous amounts of opiate painkillers being prescribed, as well as sedatives, as well as muscle relaxers, with over 12 patients allegedly dying as a result of this prescribing from overdoses, I was immediately fascinated. It was, as I describe in the book, a combination of the familiar that Volkman and my dad had once, you know, on paper they seemed so similar, but there was also the foreign there of here were two guys with similar backgrounds who went in really different directions with their lives, and that was what drew me into the book.
Were you initially sympathetic with his situation?
I wouldn't say I was initially sympathetic. Again, I was going in blind, more or less. Volkman was not a guy, I say in the book, who, you know, I hung out with growing up. He didn't come over to my house for barbecues. I had never heard of him. I went in, I would say, with an open mind. I had read the coverage of his case, what kind of little there was. There was an article in the Columbus Dispatch following his indictment, and really not much else. And certainly those, that initial coverage in the indictment was incriminating and laid out what appeared to be a very sketchy situation. But I didn't really know much more than that. So, and I was interested in who this guy was because I really knew nothing aside from the fact that he and my dad shared these experiences long ago on their resume. What had happened in between the time that my dad and Volkman graduated in the mid-70s and Volkman's indictment, the span of 30 years or so, was entirely unknown to me. So I'd say I went in skeptical of what Volkman told me, but with an open mind. I hadn't yet been to Southern Ohio and heard what the folks down there had to say, which was certainly important to understanding the story, nor had I heard what he had to say. So that was my attitude going in.
My guest is Philip Isle. His book is Prescription for Pain. You just said what Volkman told me, revealing that You had access to him. Your connection through your dad made it possible for you to interview him. Tell us what this was like and what you ended up doing.
Well, it is true that when I reached out to Volkman after his indictment and before his trial, there was a period of about 4 years when I was just getting started in my journalism career. This is many years ago now. I was in my mid-20s, and I was about to enter a graduate writing program at Columbia University in New York. And I did mention the connection that I was his former classmate's son reaching out. But I want to be clear that Volkman, because of his personality, a very brash, arrogant, defiant, even grandiose guy who at no point in the more than decade that I spoke with him admitted any kind of fault in this criminal scheme or in the malpractice cases that preceded it, I don't necessarily think it took the son of a former classmate for this guy to open up. Yes, that was my entry point, but I really think he would have been eager to speak to anyone knocking at his door. It just turned out to be me. So I reached out to him in 2009, explaining who I was, explaining the approach I just discussed, how I had read a bit about his case online, but I had an open mind, and I was curious to hear his side of the story. Didn't necessarily think he would agree to it, but I sent that letter off in the fall of 2009, and I got a phone call a couple weeks later from Paul Volkman saying he would be willing to speak to me. So a few months later, during what was my Christmas vacation for my graduate program, I drove from New York to Chicago, sat down with him for a few days, multiple hours on multiple days, returned the following summer for more interviews. These were recorded with his permission. So all told, before the trial, I had 15-plus hours of recorded interviews with him. And then after his trial, after his conviction, I continued to correspond with him in county jail in Hamilton County, in Butler County, outside of Cincinnati, and then later in federal prison. So part of the book, what I draw from, is really this mountain of material drawn directly from Paul Volkman, words he wrote or words he spoke. But he is, as I would learn, a very unreliable narrator. Mm-hmm. It's not an exaggeration to call him flat-out dishonest, or at least his statements don't stand up to scrutiny and fact-checking. And so over the course of my book, at various junctures in his life and in his career, I say what he says happened, and then I say what other folks say happened, or what the facts as shown in open court or in various documents say, and I'm constantly toggling back and forth between the two.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, community-owned public radio for curious listeners. I've been joined on the telephone in Rhode Island by Philip Isle. His book, Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer, just out in paperback. He joins us on the phone. And Phil, you really do a fantastic job of putting together his history and following the chronology. You mentioned a moment ago the word malpractice. Some doctors seem to have a God complex, and he certainly seems to fit into that category. This is a guy who could never admit he did anything wrong, and you went back and you did some digging, and you found he did do some things wrong, even early in his career.
That's right. So Volkman does not arrive in Ohio to begin his tenure in what he claims was pain medicine, what prosecutors claim was drug dealing, until 2003. And he's in his 50s at that point. He's had a lengthy medical career. He's a grown-up guy. He's got grown children. And in the first part of my book, the first of five sections, I take readers inside his life and his career and explore the factors, the events, the actions that led to his choice to work at a cash-only pain clinic in southern Ohio, right on the Ohio River. And I found an unusual career. He and my dad were trained to be medical researchers. In fact, the federal government, through a program called the Medical Scientist Training Program, MSTP, paid for their education and had high hopes for them. Volkman flamed out of medical research fairly early on. For reasons I explore, like many things, he says it was one thing. I found that other folks said it was another. From there, in the early 80s, this is in Chicago, he goes into pediatrics and has some success there. And there were some folks who said he was a decent pediatrician, but he found that he wasn't making enough money for his liking or to support his growing family. He had a wife and two young kids at that point. And so he starts moonlighting in local emergency rooms in Chicago on evenings and weekends in the 1980s. And then over time, he expands that emergency room work. He's still working part-time as a pediatrician, but he starts taking temporary jobs around the Midwest, what are called locum tenens jobs, which is kind of a fancy medical term for temp work. And he found, somewhat counterintuitively, that he could actually make more money doing emergency room work outside of the big city of Chicago in smaller towns around the Midwest, which were in more need of emergency room doctors. So he ultimately got medical licenses in six states. He worked in places like Appleton, Wisconsin, and Marion, Illinois, these kind of small, out-of-the-way Midwest towns. And over the span of about 20 years, working in both pediatrics and emergency medicine, he faces a handful of malpractice lawsuits. Lawsuits which, much like the criminal charges he would later face, he claims to have no responsibility for. He's told me repeatedly and told anyone who would listen that he was a victim of out-of-control malpractice laws, predatory lawyers, patients looking for a payout. But as you indicated in your question, I looked more closely at these cases, and there was some real harm done there to both pediatrics patients and emergency patients. People lost limbs. Another guy had serious mental health deficiencies from an undiagnosed brain bleed. And it was a bit murky to figure out who was to blame here. But I did find the facts as I could determine them from a couple cases that went to trial, others that were settled, were much more incriminating than Volkman let on in our interviews.
Wow, it's quite a story. It's Prescription for Pain. Philip Isle wrote it, just out in paperback, how a once promising doctor became the pill mill killer. We need to take a break, and then we're going to continue our conversation with Phil about Dr. Paul Volkman right after this. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. I've been joined on the telephone in Rhode Island by Philip Isle. He's the author of Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. And it just came out in paperback. We had him on the show for the hardcover. I was so impressed by this book, I had to have him back for the paperback release. Phil, let's talk about Dr. Volkman's activities here in this region and didn't he essentially become uninsurable due to the malpractice problems?
That's right. So before the break, I was explaining what happened in the early decades of Volkman's career, how he faced a number of malpractice lawsuits related to his work as both a pediatrician and a traveling emergency room doctor. And really the pivotal moment of this pre-criminal era in his career is when in the early 2000s, after a number of these malpractice, be they verdicts against him, there were a couple of those, or settlements by his insurer, after these pile up, malpractice insurers say, we don't want to insure you anymore. When I talk about the book, I compare this to a driver who has gotten into a lot of accidents driving their car, and they might find it hard to get car insurance at that point. That's basically what happened to Volkman in medical terms. So in the early 2000s, he is out of luck, basically. He's uninsurable, and this drastically reduces his possibilities for employment as a doctor. And he is basically desperate for work. He told me at one point he was chopping vegetables in a restaurant kitchen in Chicago. This is a guy who was living on Lakeshore Drive, who had an MD and a PhD from the University of Chicago, a bit overqualified for that. But he couldn't find a job until he said that he found a job listing online. He was looking around online for possible gigs and found one at a cash-only pain clinic in Southern Ohio called Tri-State Healthcare, owned and operated by a woman down there who had, as it turned out, no medical training, didn't have a college degree, in fact. Her name was Denise Huffman. She would ultimately be indicted alongside Volkman. But medical malpractice insurance wasn't required for the job. And so he picked up the phone and made the call, and they were off to the races at that point. He was one of the oddest things. I mean, there's so many unusual facts about this case. Volkman never fully moved to Southern Ohio. He, for a period of nearly 3 years, was commuting from Chicago to Portsmouth, Ohio, or later Chillicothe, on a weekly basis. He would wake up early Monday morning, fly from Chicago to Columbus, drive 2 hours to Portsmouth, stay the week in Portsmouth, and then return on Friday. And this was his life for the better part of 3 years.
They were making so much money. I'm trying to picture his period when he was chopping vegetables and how pleasant it must have been to be one of his coworkers while he was there with the knife chopping the vegetables. I'm sure he was just a delight to be around. This guy had a very expensive lifestyle. You mentioned his apartment overlooking the lake on Lakeshore Drive in Chicago, where he could afford to go back there every weekend to be with his family, to be with his wife, who apparently had expensive tastes like he did. Let's talk about the patients and the setup here and just the number of people that were going through there and the amount of prescriptions that he was writing and the fact that they were writing so many prescriptions, they finally had to start doing it in-house.
Right. So what I learned in, you know, my entry point to this story was this guy who went to medical school with my dad who broke bad, so to speak. But when I first went to Portsmouth in 2010, which was, again, when I first entered the story between the time of Volkman's indictment and his trial, I wound up, and that was the first of 10 trips I made over the course of about a decade. I really grew quite fond of the place. I'm still quite fond of it. I've been there since the book came out. But I learned that operations like this, sketchy, non-hospital-affiliated pain clinics, which take only cash, which have high security, which don't offer an array of medical services and are mainly just prescribing pills, this was not a unique creation to Paul Volkman. He and Denise Huffman, the woman who ran the clinic, were actually following kind of a tried and true model for the area, whether in Southern Ohio or across the river in Kentucky. And what I learned in my research is that a number of doctors had been charged with criminal activity in this area for very similar operations before Volkman, and a number of doctors got themselves into trouble for very similar activity after Volkman. So I think it's important when folks listen to Volkman's claims of his innocence that if you zoom out, he is part of a crime spree spanning 20 years, which sent over a dozen doctors to prison from this very small, not super densely populated part of Appalachian Ohio and Kentucky. And the way these clinics worked is folks came in, they needed some kind of medical documentation. I also learned in my research that faking MRIs was kind of a spin-off black market business down in this area. In order to get into a clinic to see a doctor. And some of the folks whose backgrounds I looked into, they really did have pain. They had been in car accidents. They had sports injuries. They had, you know, injuries from manual labor. But over time, they were getting prescribed so many pills. Again, this trifecta, this cocktail of opiates, of sedatives like Valium, of muscle relaxers. And there was this pattern you would hear about. Folks who started out with real pain, those medical issues becoming kind of subsumed, overcome by issues related to addiction. And you would just hear tragic stories of loved ones of these folks who were distressed by the amount of pills they were getting, who were distressed by their behavior, you know, whether they were nodding off at inopportune times, whether they were stealing, taking things from the house and pawning them to get money. It was really sad stories. Some of these folks contacted the clinic, asked them to stop prescribing to their loved one. Some went to the clinic in person. And as you said, Vic, pretty early on, Volkman's prescriptions were so high, so unusual, that local pharmacies stopped filling them. They thought, these are sketchy, these are dangerous. We don't like the look of the patients who were coming in. They seem too young to need these pills. They don't seem to have the kind of ailments that would require these heavy-duty prescriptions. And very early on, within a couple months, he and Denise were shut out by local pharmacies. But what they did was they submitted an application to the Ohio State Board of Pharmacy for a license to prescribe to dispense pills on site. And they were given a green light to do that. They were supposed to abide by strict rules, which they didn't. But from that point on, this clinic, Tri-State Healthcare, became a one-stop shop where Volkmann could see patients, prescribe them medications, and they could literally walk down the hall, pay more cash, and walk away with a lot of pills. And that was how this clinic ran for quite a while.
Weren't they number one? Wasn't he like the number one prescriber of, was it OxyContin perhaps? Or?
So for the year of 2004, Paul Volkmann, a single doctor working out of this small clinic in a tiny town, was the number one purchaser of oxycodone in the country. Purchaser, because at this point, he was the one making the purchases for the on-site dispensary. And the reason he was purchasing so much was because so much was moving out the door. So yes, he was nationally ranked from, you know, a town of 20,000 people in southern Ohio.
We're number one. We're number one. OxyContin, capital of the world. Yeah, go, team, go. My guess is Philip Isle. I shouldn't make a joke about it. It's not funny at all. It's horrible. And Ohio was gripped in this. Really, it was terrible. And I was curious about the fake MRIs and how that works. And I also was curious about, you mentioned a dozen doctors who were prosecuted who were doing the same kind of stuff Volkmann was. How many of them are serving four life sentences and are still in prison?
I haven't done the math on who is still in prison, but one of the reasons this case sticks out, and not just sticks out for the region, but sticks out nationally, in my research on this book about a doctor who was convicted of prescription drug dealing during the opiate epidemic, I was, of course, interested in how many doctors were there nationally to do this. I never found an exact tally, but I did find a journal article that tracked media coverage of these cases and found that over a period of about 25 years, from the mid-90s to about 2020, there were over 300 doctors charged with similar crimes in various states. Certainly, we've seen them in my neck of the woods in Rhode Island and in New England, and there have been hot spots like Ohio, like South Florida. But one of the reasons the Volkmann case stands out is because he didn't accept a plea deal. He was so defiant, so insistent that he was a good doctor, a conscientious doctor who was treating his patients appropriately and so on, that he, even though he faced a much higher potential sentence for taking these things to trial, taking his case to trial, he wouldn't take a plea deal. And so his case went to a trial, and not only was he convicted, but he showed an utter lack of remorse at all stages during the trial and particularly during the sentencing when he said, I have no apologies to make. He called the judge a heinous criminal during that sentencing hearing. So those are a couple of the factors that lead to this extraordinary sentence of four consecutive life terms, which I've looked at as many cases as I could find in this era, both from Ohio and even across the country, and I've yet to find a case where the of a doctor convicted where the sentence matches or exceeds that. I really think it's a high watermark for this entire era.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Philip Isle. His book, Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer, just out in paperback. He joins us on the phone in Rhode Island. And eventually, he did stop communicating with you. I'm wondering, have you mailed him an autographed copy of the book? And what did he think about it?
You know, that is the question since the book came out about a year ago I've gotten the most. And I get it. What does Dr. Volkmann think about this? And I don't know. I interviewed him for a couple years before his trial in person, continued to correspond with him through around 2017, 2018, when I wrote an article about his case for Cincinnati Magazine called The Pill Mill That Ravaged Portsmouth. And Volkmann didn't like that article, to put it mildly, because it did not tell the story that he wanted me to tell, which is of the noble, compassionate doctor besieged by an out-of-control government. That wasn't the story as I saw it. That wasn't the story as I wrote it. And so he stopped speaking to me then and called me a bunch of names, as he was inclined to do. We didn't speak for a few years. We briefly reconnected after I got my book deal in 2021, when I knocked on his door in federal prison again, so to speak, and we briefly corresponded. And then he did something he had done before, which was try to enlist me in helping me in one of his legal schemes to get out of prison. In this case, he wanted me to do research for an argument he was trying to make that he needed to be let out on compassionate grounds because of his age and his medical ailments. And I said what I told him before, which is, I'm not on your team. I'm not your PR guy. I'm not your researcher. I'm a journalist. I'm not going to do this research for you. And that infuriated him, as similar boundary setting had done before, and he stopped speaking to me in 2021. And I haven't spoken to him since. I let him know the book was coming out in the fall of 2023 when I knew what the pub date was going to be. I knew what the book's title was going to be. I wrote him a letter letting him know. And once the book came out last spring, I sent him another brief letter saying, Paul, the book is out. This is the title. I can send you a copy if you want. And I never heard back. So I really don't know if he's read it. I don't know if he has access to it in prison. I can only imagine if he has read it, he doesn't like it, because if he was displeased with the magazine article I wrote, this is a much, much longer and more detailed and more incriminating story than that. Although I should note, I didn't set out to bury this guy. I set out to find the truth. And it turns out the truth was not flattering in the least.
I'm not your PR guy. I like that. I wish I had the nerve to say that to people occasionally, because I have people that want me to be their PR guy, and it's not what I do. My guest is Philip Isle. We're getting ready to take a break here in a minute, but quickly before we take the break, let's say I need a fake MRI. How do I get one, Phil? How does that work?
Well, I think the fake MRI operations had been closed down by the time I arrived in southern Ohio. But I would imagine, you know, one of the things that's important to know about these pain clinics is that a lot of people made money from them. The owners made money, the doctors made money, and many of the patients made money when they turned around after receiving their high-volume prescriptions and sold a lot of the pills. So there was money to be made with fake MRIs. So these were a real financial, black market financial engine in a region that was really economically depressed. And in the book, I felt it was important for me to kind of zoom out and tell the history of this place, of Portsmouth, Ohio, of Scioto County, of the broader region, so folks understood how it was that these clinics took root there.
And the Sacklers made money. I know your book isn't about them, but wow. What a story. That's a totally different story. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and Philip Isle has joined us. His book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer, just out in paperback. He joins us on the phone in Providence, Rhode Island, beautiful Providence. And we'll continue our conversation right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I've been joined on the telephone today by Philip Isle. His book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. His name was Paul Volkman, and he's still in prison. And the book, we had you on a year ago for the hardcover, and now you've had a year of experience being out there on the road. You've done a ton of events. You're a busy guy. You are willing to do all kinds of outreach. I know you do book club drop-ins on Zoom and that kind of stuff. And I understand, I heard a rumor that recently you did a drop-in in Dayton, Ohio. How'd that go for you?
So the Dayton event was a Zoom event with a Jewish community center there. I was a couple weeks before that lucky enough to be flown out to Athens, my first time at Ohio University for a book talk there. And previously, in the year or so since the book came out, I have gone to Ohio as frequently as I can. I've done events in Cleveland, in Toledo, in Columbus, in Cincinnati, and I've certainly done a number of events in Scioto County, Springfield. I went to a library there in Scioto County in Portsmouth and Ironton down in that region where all this took place. It, you know, it's my first time writing a book, so a lot of this is just enthusiasm to get the word out. But I felt so much gratitude toward the folks in Ohio who had been so hospitable to me over the years and shared their stories with me and believed in this story and understood why, you know, this random journalist from Rhode Island would want to come and learn about it. So it's been so meaningful to me to speak to all of these different audiences across the state of Ohio. And, you know, since I'm here, I should mention that I'm happy to keep doing it. I mean, I kind of have a standing invitation that if libraries or book clubs or schools or whatever want me to speak to them about this very Ohio story, I would be happy to do it.
The last time we had you on was right before you were coming to the Clark County Public Library in Springfield. So I know what you're talking about, Phil. And of course, the folks over at the Jewish Community Center, I've worked with them on some projects over the years, and I'm sure that was a great audience for you.
One of the reasons I stuck with this book for so long, Vic, I mean, I was working on this on and off for more than a decade, and certainly other book ideas came and went during that time. I have a lot of folders of book ideas that went nowhere, but this one I could never shake because there was so much here to talk about. There was so much medical stuff about opiates, about pain, about addiction. There was legal stuff, whether it be malpractice, whether it be criminal stuff. And there was a ton of Ohio stuff. You know, this is an Ohio story. Volkman's crimes took place in southern Ohio. His trial took place in Cincinnati. He was sending patients at one point up to get their scripts filled at a sketchy pharmacy in Columbus. And the turnout for these events has been great. There have been former prosecutors. There have been medical people. Yes, there have been DEA agents, and down in Portsmouth and in that area, there have been, you know, you don't have to look very far to find folks who are connected in some way to the opiate epidemic. And I've just had some really lovely conversations with folks down there, answered their questions that have made the whole project seem worthwhile.
I grew up in Des Moines, and our football coach at our high school, he had some kids, and one of his sons grew up to become a big drug dealer in Des Moines, and they kept arresting him, and finally they caught him for the fourth time with 869 grams of meth, $18,000 in cash. He refused to cooperate with the prosecutors, and they sentenced him to a mandatory life sentence, and so he's in prison, and he obviously doesn't want to be there. And the prosecutors were very opposed to him ever being pardoned. Well, he was able, through connections, to get to George W. Bush right at the end of his second term. And he got pardoned, and he got out of prison. And we've seen the presidential pardon thing over the years. Both parties, I think, have abused it. We had Bill Clinton, when he was leaving office, who did a notorious pardon of Mark Rich. Under Ronald Reagan and Clinton, one out of 100 people that applied for pardons got them. Under George W. Bush, it was one out of 1,000. Under Obama, it was one out of 5,000. I don't know what the stats are going to be for Donald Trump, but your guy, Paul Volkman, you describe how he was very progressive politically, but by the time he ended up in prison, he took a real hard turn to the right. And I kept thinking about this as I was rereading your book about how this guy seems to be an ideal candidate for a presidential pardon based on the pardons that have been coming out of Trump and, frankly, out of Joe Biden. I mean, we have this whole controversy right now where Trump is claiming that Biden used an auto pen to pardon all these people. Biden claimed he would never pardon Hunter Biden. Trump claims Biden made a big mistake not issuing a pardon for himself. I'm fascinated by this pardon process. We've got all these January 6 people walking free. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a chance that Paul Volkman might get a pardon from Donald Trump because of his new politics?
Well, I keep looking on the dockets online where new documents from this case are posted because I fully expect he will ask for one. This is a guy who has no shortage of energy for advocating his own case. He has tried any number of ways to get out of prison, exhausting all appeals, you know, asking for compassionate release. So I fully expect, and as you mentioned, despite the fact that Volkman was a MSNBC watching fan of Bernie Sanders and Al Franken when I first met him in 2009. By the time we stopped speaking in the early 2020s, he had taken a hard right turn, was severely critical of President Obama and Hillary Clinton, and was a big fan of Donald Trump. And I imagine he's trying every which way to get Trump's attention and ask for a pardon. Whether he will be able to do that is an open question. And I'm sure that there are a lot of criminals behind bars right now who see Trump's kind of loose pen with the pardons and are vying for the same. So I'm sure there's a lot of competition there, and it remains to be seen whether Volkman can prevail on Trump to let him free.
Well, it certainly came to my mind. And you also, you cover his trial, and let's talk a little bit about his demeanor during the trial.
Well, I was only at the trial for a little while. Again, so many, there were hundreds of these cases over the course of the opiate epidemic, but only a small fraction of them went to a trial. So from my perspective, as a journalist, as kind of a historian, I had this remarkable document to draw from in the trial record. Because Volkman refused a plea deal, this went to a lengthy trial involving 70 witnesses from the government, 10 from the defense, and the transcript was over 4,000 pages of sworn testimony. And so I was able to tell the story, take my readers inside the courtroom. And in fact, I was able to speak to a few jurors and get their perspective as well on how this all appeared to them. And I also talk about Volkman's demeanor during the sentencing. In the trial, I know less about it because I wasn't there for most of the time. I do know that despite his adamant statements to me beforehand that, of course, he was going to testify in his own defense, when the time came, he declined. A decision that he would later blame his defense attorneys for, which is typical of him, as opposed to accepting any responsibility for that. I know that at some point during the trial, might have been when the jury was out and deliberating, Volkman sent a Facebook message, a nasty kind of aggressive Facebook message to a former employee of his who had testified for the prosecution, calling her names, asking her how she lived with herself, that sort of thing. That was then forwarded to the prosecutors who presented it to the judge and asked for a kind of an order that Volkman not contact anyone, which was granted. And then, as I mentioned during the sentencing hearing, when he had had a falling out with his attorneys and was acting as his own advocate at that point, he was completely unrepentant. And he was combative. He was arguing with the judge. He demanded of the judge that she call him Dr. Volkman, which she refused, said, you know, that would be an honorary title at this point. I decide not to. And as I said, he called her names, called her a criminal. And he made no effort to make amends. He remained defiant. And that behavior certainly contributed to the sentence.
She was a great judge. I love it that he used Facebook for anti-social media. And you talked to a lot of people. You talked to the loved ones of some of the people who died, who allegedly were OD victims using his prescriptions. And the most fascinating period for me was near the end of his career as the pill mill dispenser.
You know, he was in Portsmouth for about two years and change. And for most of that time, he had this kind of odd couple business relationship with Denise Huffman, who was from the region, who had no medical experience, had worked in fast food restaurants and factories, and yet they had this mutually beneficial relationship where she ran the clinic and he was the doctor who wrote the scripts. And that worked for both of them. Until it didn't. And they parted ways in the fall of their late summer of 2005, both of whom, not surprisingly, blamed the other one for being corrupt. And so Volkman is basically kicked out of the building where he had been working, which was a not particularly glitzy, but at least it was a medical building. And for a period of a few weeks, when he's trying to figure out his next move, he decides he's going to run a pain clinic out of the house that he rented on a quiet residential street in Portsmouth, a short brick-paved street I've been there. I've taken photos. I've interviewed people there. Not the kind of place where there are any businesses, let alone a unmarked, highly popular pain clinic. And the neighbors were certainly not pleased about this development. This sleepy street became crammed with cars. People were arriving at all times of day. You had folks milling around in crowds in front of the house, behind the house. They were knocking on the neighbor's door, asking for the doctor because there was no sign on the house. There was a security guard walking around with a gun holstered to his hip. It was not much of an attempt to be inconspicuous. And Volkman, true to form, during this time and afterward, maintained that this was all legitimate. And his neighbors were enraged. They were apparently calling the police, asking for help nonstop. And eventually the police did come and shut down that clinic. Not the first time authorities had shut down a Volkman clinic. And yet even then, a lot of doctors would have said, I'm done. He did not. That's when he went up the road to Chillicothe and started up again and practiced there for a few more months before he was shut down for good.
That is so creepy, and that's right. I got the timeline screwed up there. He went into Portsmouth to this house where he'd been living, and I'm just picturing being one of those neighbors and suddenly looking out the window and saying, who are all these people parked all around my house, and they're all hanging around on the porch, and they're throwing their fast food wrappers in my yard, and what on earth is going on? It would just drive you crazy.
Yes. I spoke with one next-door neighbor who told me about how unpleasant this time was for her. And I also found a clipping from the Portsmouth Daily Times, the newspaper from around this time. And one of the neighbors, when they finally came to shut him down, said, a lot of people are really ticked off around here. So Volkman, on that street and more generally in Southern Ohio, made no attempts to endear himself to the community.
Philip Ild has been our guest. His book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. And this was your first book, and it took many years of research and just a lot of time and effort on your part. And I'm wondering, is the second book project out there somewhere? Have you identified it yet? Are you thinking about it? What's going on?
Well, I had one idea, which is still an idea, which is about the Freedom of Information Act. I got involved in a lawsuit as a result of my research on this first book. I needed to sue the DEA under the FOIA to get access to thousands of pages of material from Volkman's case. And I still want to write that book. But in the meantime, I've become really interested in a story that's happening right basically in my backyard. I live in Providence, Rhode Island, where I'm speaking to you from. And just up the street from me, about 5 miles from where I live and where I grew up, in the tiny town of Central Falls, is a privately run federal detention center where criminals have been taken as they await trial, but it's also become a holding center for ICE, for immigrations in recent years. And this place has beyond a checkered past. It's been a subject of a lot of controversy. There are constantly protests there. And it's just a fascinating and disturbing story. So right now I'm keen to tell the story of this particular detention center in the tiny town of Central Falls in Rhode Island, and we'll see if that goes anywhere. But it feels both topical, but like the Volkman book, it's a very specific story that gets at a lot of bigger issues. And so hopefully I will be telling you about that book at some point down the road, Vic.
Did you say you're living in El Salvador? That's a really scary topic, Phil. We live in a lot of fear right now in this current situation we're living in. Yeah. In the United States. I think that's a really kind of a scary project, Phil. I don't know, Phil.
Well, I mean, I am helplessly drawn to dark stories, Vic. This story that I'm here to talk to you about, Prescription for Pain, was nothing if not dark. Sometimes I forget how dark it is, and then when I'm at a bookstore or an event and people walk up to me who don't know about the book and they ask what I write about and I describe it, a lot of folks just say, ooh, no thanks, that's a little dark for me. And I'm reminded, oh yeah, This is about death and corruption and a nasty guy who refuses to take responsibility. So I think those are the stories I'm drawn to. And in this case, there's one just up the road from me in Rhode Island.
Well, It's a great story, the one you're thinking about, as well as this one. And I can only imagine what strange places you would have to dig into to do the research for that one, because I'm sure that there's a lot there. And I'm also wondering, as you've been out and about, have you had a lot of people come up to you that have personal experiences with the pill mill situation, people that have come up to you and said, you know, I lost my loved one, I lost someone that I cared about deeply? Has that happened?
Oh, yeah. When I was down in Portsmouth in the fall, I did a few different events. I did one at Shawnee State University, the college that's there. I did one at the library, and I also did one at a local rehabilitation center. And Portsmouth is a small town, and the history I was writing about wasn't ancient history. It was, you know, the mid-2000s. So there were people reading the book at those events who knew folks who I was writing about, both, you know. And so that was really striking to see. And I will never forget, I was at an event in Ashland, Kentucky, and just across the river. And somebody came up to me who was from Scioto County and told me, you are part of the healing of this area. Uh-huh. And, you know, I could retire right there. To have written a book that affected somebody local on that level and prompted them to say that, it just meant the world to me that I could write something that would help folks make sense of what was going on there. And I hope, you know, chart a healthier future.
Well, I got to give it to you. I applaud your efforts. Investigative journalism is a very dangerous profession these days. Investigative journalists are an endangered species. And I'm so happy that we have people like you out there working to uncover things and to write about them and to do such an excellent job of digging and finding the truth.
And I, in turn, am happy for folks like you, Vic, who are helping us spread the word. So I so appreciate you having me on for the first time and having me on again. It's always a pleasure. And I will certainly take you out to lunch if you're ever in my neck of the woods in Rhode Island.
And if you ever do write a second book, if I'm still doing this, Phil, I'd love to have you back on the program. I know these projects can take a long time to complete.
Well, that's a little bit more fuel in my tank to keep this next project rolling and to get it out there.
The book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. Philip Isle wrote it. It's just out in paperback, and he's been my guest on the Book Nook today. And just one more question before I let you go.
Mm-hmm.
What did your dad think about the book?
My dad was wonderfully supportive of me. He, because of the nature of the project and the fact that he had fallen out of touch with Paul, there was no resistance there. It wasn't like I was smearing the name of somebody who was still a close friend of his. I was digging into a mystery that he wondered about as well. So he was super supportive of me, and he was also saddened by the story I told and by the questions I answered for him about what happened to his old classmate. So yeah, I would say it was a mix of supportive of me and really sad about what had become of this promising guy who he had once known.
Well, I'm going to guess that he's just as proud as can be that you wrote this and that you did such an excellent job. Thanks again, Phil.
Thank you so much, Rick.
My guest has been Philip Isle. The book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the Pill Mill Killer. Just out in paperback. You heard about it on the Book Nook on WYSO. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.